Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guests today are Anchorage physician Dr. Jack Hickel and Jason Hahn. Jason is the program director of the Alaska Sudan Medical Project. Both Dr. Hickel and Jason and the Alaska Sudan Medical Project have been helping the semi-nomadic Nuer people of South Sudan for a number of years now. We've had Dr. Hickel on about 4 years ago talking about some of the work, and we're back talking about the progression and the continued needs of these individuals who have been battling health issues as a result of a lot of significant civil war and fighting that really continues to be somewhat of an issue in that area. During the program today, if you've got questions or comments, you can reach us by calling directly 550-8433. That's our number in Anchorage, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Jason and Dr. Hickel, welcome once again to Line 1.
Thank you, Thad, for having me again. It's a pleasure to be here and to share a little bit about what's been going on since we last talked 4 years ago.
So, Jack, I'd mentioned that I've had this the third time on the program. First time you were in Swaziland. You hadn't found Sudan yet.
That's right.
And you're continuing to do this. So you've been doing this kind of humanitarian aid kind of issue from a medical standpoint, plus other things, I'm sure, for almost 20 years. 30 years.
Yeah. That tells you how old I am. Sorry about that.
Well, I probably got you, but we won't go there. And Jason, you've just joined the organization. Jack was telling us as their program manager, program director.
Yeah, that's right. I've been involved a couple of years now. Went on my first trip over to Sudan 2 years ago, and have just been a program manager, I think, about 6 months or so.
How'd you get into this business?
Boy, I just talked to the wrong guy somewhere.
That'll do it.
Exactly. I talked to a guy I know, and he was telling me about the project. And I was curious, wondering what was going on, so I went to a meeting. And right when I went to the meeting and saw the group of people they had and what they were doing, what they're talking about, I was hooked. So I went over for my first trip 2 years ago, and then, I've been involved in the board and now as the program director, because it's a pretty amazing project.
Jack, tell us, let's start about the country and the people and what it's like over there.
Well, we're now working in a new country, South Sudan. As most of the listeners are aware, it was Sudan, but after nearly 50 years of civil war, they came to a peace agreement, and the South voted to become independent from the North. As of July last year, they became independent. So where we're working now is in South Sudan. The war has been over for a number of years now, and we're working in a state called Jonglei State, one of the most undeveloped and impoverished states in South Sudan.
You had mentioned, although you'd been in Swaziland in South Africa for a number of years prior, you, at least in my recollection and in some of our interactions by email and so forth, were really impressed with the severity of the problems, I think it's fair to say, when you first visited. Can you flesh that out for us a little bit?
Very much. Swaziland certainly had huge problems. There was a huge problem with famine and starvation there, huge problem with poor infrastructure and medical care. And I worked in Mozambique right after the war there, and that was one of the worst places I'd ever worked in. I'd worked briefly in the Congo. I went into Sudan in 2007 and found a situation there that really was probably right at the top, comparing with Mozambique, in terms of need, poverty, disease, famine, starvation. It was a mess.
What's the origin of this? We've talked about that there was civil war, but how does civil war aggravate what probably is already a kind of marginal lifestyle?
Well, you take, first of all, a country that was minimally developed to begin with. The British left there in 1956, and there wasn't much there. Some development, even in the village we were working in, the British had been there. They built a half dozen brick buildings some of which are still standing. But there was very little development. Then you put that on top of 40 years of civil war. So you have a generation and a half of people that have had no education or minimal. There's no education in our area, no immunizations, minimal health care, no infrastructure, no cash-based economy. You have a people that basically are nomadic and semi-nomadic, which during the war, they were displaced. Villages were destroyed and people were displaced. And so you have a people that have really no basis from which to rescue themselves.
How did the Civil War then impact on that?
Well, in terms of our area, the countrywide?
Yeah, in the people in particular, the New Heirs.
Well, in our area, we're on a branch of the Nile. And the war did come into that area somewhat. I mean, the gunboats had come up and down the river and shell the villages, so all the people pulled back from the river. The river is their lifestyle, their lifeblood. That's where they get their water. That's where they can do their crops and stuff. So they all got displaced away from the river into drier lands. And it just caused havoc amongst their people and their families. They moved their villages. Villages were destroyed and burned, and people were displaced. Mm-hmm. And with that comes all the disruption that comes with no health care and no economy and no immunizations and no education. Mm-hmm. And that went on for decades.
Mm-hmm. Malnutrition, I guess, is one of the biggest factors then and when you first went over there and still, is that fair to say?
When I first went there, there really weren't any statistics as to what the prevalence was. A guesstimation for Sudan as a whole was 36% of the kids suffer from significant malnutrition. But that was for the whole country of Sudan. South Sudan was certainly much higher because that's where the war was fought. The rate of malnutrition in 2007 was certainly much higher than the 36% published. But how high? We do not know. Yes, it is a significant factor and exacerbated by numerous other factors. Right now, there's a huge famine going on. Crops were destroyed this last season because of too much rain and flooding on the Nile. And so, what problems they had with malnutrition are exacerbated now because there was near total crop failure this past year.
I've been reading a little history. As I get older, I guess I'm more interested in that. And one of the things we don't realize in our current civilization is how much older civilizations and people that are still living this kind are dependent on the weather. And so
Absolutely.
You have huge famine because there's no rain, and you have real problems because there's too much rain, and you have no control over those things. You
Definitely.
Can't go buy something. And so people are inevitably really, really trapped when just a year or two of drought or a year or two of too much water can hugely affect things.
Yeah.
Jason, what was your experience once you first went over there?
The same. I mean, you just realize these people have, like, nothing. I mean, that's the best way to describe it. They don't really have clean water. Mm-hmm. That's part of the reason we're there. If it wasn't for Dr. Jill and this Dr. Jill Seaman in this village, they'd have no health care. They have very little food. I mean, they have a tiny market with a few goods, but really they're just living a lifestyle that they probably lived, 500 years ago. Just they live in their mud huts and it's a struggle for survival every day. You know, they're really a cattle culture, so that's really everything to them revolves around their cattle. So beyond that, there's just not much.
We haven't really fleshed this aspect of the issue out. In many countries where there's some impoverished people, non-government organizations may come in, Doctors Without Borders, Engineers Without Borders, all these things to help. But in this situation, as I understand, and you guys correct me now, because of the war and everything, and continuing safety issues, security issues make it that these other organizations don't exist. So people like yourselves, and we mentioned Jill Seaman, who we talked about in the last program, which we probably need to talk about too, are all there is as far as some aid.
That's basically true. It is changing. Doctors Without Borders was there until about 92, but they left because of the war.
Right, okay.
It was taken over by Samaritan's Purse, the medical work there. Samaritan's Purse pulled out because of insecurity issues too. And basically all the NGOs, non-governmental aid organizations, have pulled out. None have come back in to any significant degree. There was one called MedAir, which came in for a couple of months, 3 months, and helped us, or we helped them build some outhouses, pit latrines. Carter Center was in there for a brief period of time treating trachoma. They, too, have pulled out. So there are no long-term or NGOs, aid organizations located there on a permanent basis except us and then Dr. Jill. They don't do it because they still perceive it as being very insecure, which it certainly was, but it's getting better. But one of the main issues, this place is so remote and so difficult to get to, the expense of taking materials, supplies, and personnel in there is astronomical. Samaritan's Purse, we approached a year before last, and they were looking at potentially getting involved. They said, no, it's not cost effective. And I hate to put a dollar amount right. on that, but it's not cost effective.
Well, they could put their money in a better place, I guess, sure. is the way they have to look at everybody.
You got to do it that way. You got to do it that way. And because there's no roads here and access to the village is very difficult and there's no communication set up. I mean, we've brought in our own satellite dish so we can communicate. But there's no structure there for people to work with. There's no electricity. There's no infrastructure. There's no stores. There's no housing for their employees. There's nothing.
So when you go about building a hospital, which you mentioned before we came on the air that you guys have done, you can't go down and get the wood at the store. You can't even go get it in the forest.
The Home Depot is just really funny hours there. You know.
And Jack, you were mentioning you go into Nairobi with whatever you got, and then truck it over till you hit the Nile, and then it's a 5 or 6 day trip by water just to get to the place. And
we bring in supplies either from the States if we can't purchase it in Africa, or we buy it in Nairobi. There's still not a lot we can purchase in Sudan yet, although that is changing. So we tend to buy in the States or Nairobi. We truck it across Kenya, across Uganda into Sudan, which, believe me, it's a headache getting this arranged across all these borders. Then we put it on a boat or a barge, and we barge it down the Nile. And this process takes literally months of frustration, and the rules are always changing. The goalposts are never the same, and so trying to get it done is an exercise in patience. That's for sure.
Let me remind listeners once again: you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guests today are Dr. Jack Hickel and Jason Hahn. Jason is the program director of the Alaska Soudan Medical Project, and Jack, I guess you started this project?
I did. Brett Burrows and I started this in 2008 when I got back from Sudan in December of 2007.
So if you've got questions or comments about some of the work that's being done, perhaps even your own experiences helping those that are needy, please give us a call during the next 45 minutes or so. We're at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. You can email us during the next 45 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. And let me remind you, if you've got interest in this program or this project, you can go to alaskapublic.org and the Line 1 link. And on today's program notes, there are three links that are present. One is a link directly to the website of the Alaska Soudan Medical Project where you can get information and make any help attempts that you'd like, including a direct donation link. There's a video, and then there's another more recent video that's just been added as a link if you want to see really what the work that's being done over there is all about. Also, we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So how do you go about prioritizing? I'm sure you had a priority from the beginning, but it changes a little bit. What are the priorities now?
Well, I think, Dr. Hickel will speak about this, but, I think it started with clean water, sanitation, and then just general health. So, you have Dr. Jill Seaman, who's been there. Oh, I think she's been in Old Fangak. Has it been almost 10 years now? Or
in Old Fangak, probably seven.
Seven years. No, she's been in South Sudan over 20 years. Yeah. She's an Alaskan doctor. So she's treating these people, and it's quite an undertaking that she's doing. I mean, there are times when she'll have 1,000 people at her clinic every morning. Recently there was an outbreak of a Kala Azar, which maybe we can talk about in a minute,
sure.
A disease. So she's one you know, trained Western doctor there. Now she has a local staff that she's trained. I think she has like about 50 staff now, but really she's the only Western trained doctor. And so you can just imagine, you know, just that great overwhelming need that she's dealing with. You know, these people, she treats them, they go back to living their life and you know, drinking out of the Nile under poor sanitation conditions. So they keep getting sick. You know, when Dr. Jack went in the first year, I think there was one functioning water well, and he realized that just was nowhere meeting the needs of these people. They needed clean water. So that was one of the first main projects of the Sudan Medical Project, was get these people some clean water, let's drill them some wells, so they don't just keep, you know, getting perpetually sick.
Mm-hmm. Drilling a well doesn't sound like it's necessarily easy. How'd you go about doing that?
The learning curve was steep. You know, it would be much easier if we were able to take a truck-mounted rig in there where mm-hmm. you can drill and case at the same time. Well, you right. can't do that. So ours is just a portable unit. Mm. So you drill, and hopefully it doesn't collapse before you try to get the casing in. The success rate of drilling in that part of Sudan is about 20% because of the type of soil that we're drilling in. That's not our success rate. That's mm-hmm. the success rate of people that have tried mm-hmm. this particular type of drilling in this area.
Because it's a sandy, long...
It's a black cotton soil, uh-huh. But when you do get down to sand, it just kind of collapses.
Right.
So drilling was very challenging. We now have a total of 4 wells in the village, and we have plans on doing one more, which will be at a school, which we're going to assist in putting up. There's no school in the village. So we'll have a total of 5 wells in that village. That was a challenge, but I think we've got her down.
I'm still always trying to have people understand the difficulties here. Why clean water? What's the problem without clean water? I mean, we probably have this general idea that that's probably not a good idea. You've mentioned Cal Azar. What happens without good access to clean water?
Well, the water that they have there is the Nile. Now, everybody upriver practices open defecation. And the river is tremendously polluted. So when they get their water, they're exposed to all these diseases, which give them hepatitis and gives them cholera and typhoid and all the diarrheal diseases and amoeba and giardia. And it goes on infinitely, the type of diseases you can get from bad water. And that's exactly what these people have been exposed to for decades. Mm-hmm. Consequently, the mortality rate is very high and infant mortality is very high. And people are just very, very ill because of water. Give people clean water. If you want to have an impact on people's lives in terms of health, mm-hmm. it's two things that really, really where you get your biggest bang for the buck. It's clean water and it's immunizations. Mm-hmm. And that saves lives.
Yeah, and those are, when you look at public health success stories, despite all the hullabaloo about concerns and vaccines in this country, there's nothing, like you said, that seems to approach it when you really look at the history of the world is sanitation and immunizations.
Yep.
So why can't immunizations do more for the clean water issue? Are there immunizations for cholera?
Not immunizations. Well, there is. It's not very effective.
Right.
Most of the diseases that you get from dirty water, we don't have immunizations against, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
The typhoid vaccine is works, but it's very expensive. It's not practical.
Mm-hmm.
Hepatitis is not practical there either because of the expense. Someday maybe you can do that. But all the other diarrheal diseases, your amoeba and all the other things that come down that river, there's no vaccines against it. Mm-hmm. There's no vaccines against the vast majority of illnesses that we have in that area, unfortunately. It's all infectious disease.
And if you're sick, you don't work, you're not as productive.
And if the mother or father dies, they leave an average of about 7 children without any caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
And those kids suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real tragedy. Mm-hmm. Saving the life of a mother will basically save the life of most of her kids.
Mm-hmm.
But if she dies, mm-hmm. the impact is huge.
I guess I don't want to overstate this, but this is the way the life used to be for most of us, most humans, mm-hmm. until we had sanitation and the onset of some medical advances, primarily vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
Vaccines, I've heard, well, from interviewing people who have done some of the measles work in Africa and other parts of the world in polio, I know there's a cold chain problem, and that means how do you keep these vaccines effective? Some of them need to be kept cold. They have to be frozen sometimes. And so there's huge problems just getting effective vaccine to the locations like this, it seems like.
It is huge, Thad. The problems in our area for getting vaccines are numerous. There has been no vaccine program in that part of Sudan ever. Now, Jill and ASMP have done, you know, limited vaccines in the village and a couple of the other villages there, but it's just a kind of a hit and miss. You do it when you can if there's any vaccines, but there hasn't been a program. And the vast majority of those villages have had zero vaccines for their kids. The problem is it's so remote. So we started an immunization program, Dr. Jill and ASMP, in December. We got four people trained. That was a huge barrier because who knows how to give immunizations correctly and monitor to do the record keeping and get villages mobilized. Okay, so we solved that problem. Jill got four people trained and somebody to kind of oversee the program. Then we had to get funding for it, which is huge. But then you have to get the vaccines into the village. Now, how do you do that? Who's going to supply these? Well, WHO is willing to do it, but getting them from the nearest town where there's vaccine stores into the village is very, very difficult. It's very expensive. And then, like you mentioned, the cold chain. They have to be kept cool all the way, you know, from Malakal, which is the main town, way downriver on the boat. And sometimes that boat can take a few days to get there. You got to keep it cold. You got to keep it cold in the village. How do you do that? There's no electricity. So with the solar panel, you can get a little refrigerator, but it breaks down. It doesn't last forever. So there's just one problem after the other. Right now, we have most of those issues dealt with, except now we can't get the vaccines from the store to the village because there's none in the store. WHO doesn't have them available, so the program now slumps and stops again. So it's more than just a problem in our village. It's a problem of the whole program structure in the country as a whole.
What are the vaccines that you have used and that you can use and they, you know, have the priority to be looking for? What are the diseases we're able to prevent with vaccines?
The ones that we're starting there in Sudan are the simple ones. The DPT, all moms know what that is, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. We're vaccinating against TB, which is not very effective, but it does help. And also measles, just the simple ones. They're inexpensive, but they're life-saving. Consider the fact that almost all African kids get measles. The mortality rate in some countries is 25%. If you get measles, you have a 25% chance of dying from complications of measles, pneumonia, or meningitis, encephalitis. So focusing on that, immunization itself will save a lot of children. We're talking about saving hundreds. We're talking about saving thousands of lives with this immunization program. Right now, our team is in Toch very soon, isn't it? It's a village about an hour and a half by our boat to that village. This will be the first immunizations they've ever really had, the first program to go in and make this happen. This is really exciting stuff, Dad. I mean, this is life-changing stuff. That's really having an impact. Nobody else has done it.
The Nuers, which are the main group, as I understand, that you're working with, are they receptive? They're looking forward to you guys coming back, wanting more, you know, the healthcare is something they're appreciative of?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they know about the Alaska team. We're known as the Alaska team over there. Nearby villages, they come over all the time. They want a water well in their village. They want the immunization program. So they are very receptive. There's certain medical things that they don't understand. Blood transfusions can be, there might be some superstitions with that. So
sure,
there's definitely an education process with them, but in general, I think they're very receptive to what we're doing. They see someone like Dr. Jill, who's been there so long. They have that relationship already. So they're, yeah, absolutely. I know this isn't related to the immunization, but we had some people from a village that's several miles away walk to our village and say, hey, they needed a couple pipes for their well to make it functioning again. And they just heard about the Alaska team over in Old Fangak, so they came over to ask us for their assistance.
Can you get through to people the importance of clean water? Do they understand that concept that that's where disease comes from?
Yes, they do understand that. Keep in mind, though, that they have to carry water sometimes for great distances. And if the river is closer to their hut than a well, they're going to go to the river because they have to make this trip a few times a day, and it's very time-consuming. But if there's a well close, those women will be lined up 24 hours a day.
So then they figured it out that the well is safer. Yeah.
They know the well is safer. The key is just making wells available to them.
Right.
But they're well informed of clean water.
Just I think to add on that, I mean you do have to think about those issues. I mean there's been talk of filling up some big water tanks, which be some big I don't know what they're made out of, some kind of plastic, very large water tanks. So that way, they just have it available all the time. It's faster. Well, as you can imagine, in the sun, that's going to heat up very quickly these big plastic tanks. So they're not going to want to drink, really hot water. So a lot of times, from my understanding, they haven't in the past. So you always got to think about those issues. Or they'd rather actually maybe drink cool Nile water than some hot, clean water. And that, you just have to keep those things in mind.
Well, a number of questions come to my mind, but I think that this is a good point for us to take our mid-time break here. I'll remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this break, we'll continue to take any phone calls or emails as we talk with Jason Hahn and Dr. Jack Hickel. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking with Anchorage physician Dr. Jack Hickel and Jason Hahn. He's the program director of the Alaska Sudan Medical Project. We've been discussing a little bit about what they've been doing in South Sudan. If you've got questions or comments about what you're listening to today, you can get us in a couple of ways over the next 30 minutes or so. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our direct phone number is 550-8433. Those of you outside of Anchorage, there is a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as usual, please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 o'clock Anchorage time, you're listening to a recorded broadcast. We won't be able to take your phone calls at this time. If you've got more information that you would like about the Alaska Sudan Project, go to alaskapublic.org, go to the Line 1 link, and you'll find some links directly to the project where you can even make direct donations to what the organization is doing. Let's just quickly talk about Jill Siemens. You've mentioned her name a couple of times. She was doing this work when we last talked in 2008. Jack, she's there, is my understanding, so you need to correct me, because of the difficulty with other non-governmental organizations, concerns about safety. So she and people that are helping, working with her, are there to, because no one else is getting in, people like yourself. So tell us about Jill. She worked for the Alaska Sudan Project, for example.
She doesn't actually work for us. We work together. Okay. She is kind of her own entity. She works kind of with an organization called Cross Currents International, which kind of helps organize her funding and stuff like that. But she is the she's the only doctor, not only in that village, she's the only doctor for that area up and down the river for many, many miles. I think the nearest doctor would probably be a six-hour boat ride. It would be Molokaw, I think. A six-hour boat ride down the river, so it's a long ways. She's an amazing individual, which she went over there about 22 years ago with MSF, Doctors Without Borders. They pulled out because of the security situation. The people begged the healthcare to stay in the region, but they all pulled out. Jill decided to stay and became kind of this one physician program to try to meet this huge need. And one thing that she found, and I may have mentioned this 4 years ago, Thad, when I was here, but she started looking around the area and she heard about this tremendous something going on, killing people all over this other region of South Sudan. So she had some people take her to, walking through the swamps and stuff, take her to this village. And it was a village of 1,000 people. And they were all dead. But only four people living out of a village of 1,000 people. Not knowing what it was, she started doing some investigations. It was Kalazar, which is a extremely deadly epidemic, and it's killed hundreds of thousands of people in that area. That's become her focus. That's kind of her passion right now, is trying to address this epidemic. And so she has been essentially working independently by herself with people that she has trained now and had sent out for training to try to not only combat Kalazar, but she's kind of taken on the entire public health sector as well, public health issues for all the diseases and things like that. So she's an amazing woman. She actually lives in Bethel half the year, raising support for her work over there. Then she spends the other half of the year in Old Fangak.
Let me go ahead and just mention, and I'll ask Kristen to add this to our links, but Cross Currents International Institute is crosscurrentsinstitute.org is the link, and we'll go ahead and put that up as well. Angie, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. You perhaps mentioned this earlier, but I didn't hear it, but how many people are in a village, and how many people are you working with? How many people are dying from these diseases?
Let me mention that. The village size is, we're not really certain. We're guessing between 3,000 and 5,000 people. Now, these are huts scattered throughout the bush in the region. So it's not just everybody living within a very tight area. In terms of how many people are dying or affected, let me just mention briefly about this one disease called Kalazar. It's a parasitic infection spread by the bite of the sandfly, which is very prevalent in that region. This disease, if you catch it, is 100% fatal or nearly 100% fatal. The treatment requires about 30 days of heavy metal injections. And so when we were there this last year and the year before, there was a huge epidemic of this, and we were actually treating 900 to 1,000 people a day in this little tiny village. You know, we have 10 beds, and that's about it. So most of the people will sleep elsewhere, wherever they can find a spot with a relative or under the tree or on the ground right outside the hospital, if you want to call it a hospital, please. But, you know, if you're treating 1,000 people a day, giving them injections, this overwhelms a system very, very quickly. And but they've done a very good job at addressing this, but it has overwhelmed the system. Right now, the problem is because there has been famine in that area. When people come to the village to get treated for Kalazar, and they come from all over the region, they come from villages, they may walk a week to get there. Well, when they come to the village, they have no food, so we must feed them because they're going to have to be there for a month getting treatment. Well, we don't have any food anymore. There's no food in the village, so the people don't come to Old Fangak to get treated much anymore because they know there's no food to feed them. So right now, many of them are just dying in the bush, unbeknownst to us. It's a real tragedy going on right now. I don't know if that answers your question, Angie. I kind of got diverted there, but...
Well, that's amazing. Thousands of people. I think of a village, and I think little amount of people, but it is tremendous. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about some more of the work that you've done. We talked about in the break briefly about some of these issues. The agricultural issues would be interesting for me to hear about.
Yeah, you know, just going back to just saying that these people, in the midst of a famine, I mean, really every year is just a struggle for food. Some years are better than others. I just read actually a World Food Program report for March of this year that said that right now there's 4.6 million food insecure people in South Sudan, and it was like, I think, 1.3 severely food insecure, which I guess I interpret as, you know, on the brink of starvation. So obviously food is a real big issue. Now, when you have these places like Old Fangak that are very remote, that are relying on either, you know, the food that they're producing or food from aid organizations, I mean, this is going to be a perpetual problem, you know, obviously. Going back to what Jack said, they have been, the Nuer are primary cattle, you know, nomadic cattle people. They haven't really had a lot of agriculture in their history. And then, you know, there has been some, but really it's that civil war over the last 40 years that has just caused so much chaos that they haven't really had the stability to also do agriculture. It's just something, you would think, you know, they're right on the banks of the Nile, it's very fertile ground, it's just so ripe for, you know, literally for agriculture. How come they're not doing it? That's, you know, one of the questions I asked when I, mm-hmm. when I first got there. I was like, mm-hmm. you see, you know, it was very lush within that, you know, 100, you know, yards of the Nile. It was very lush. You know, why aren't they doing it? And you start to realize they've never had the education, the experience to do it, and they don't have the infrastructure. They don't have the tools to do it. They don't have the seeds to do it. So, you know, it is an exciting program, and this is something we just started a couple of years ago. It's like, let's give these people the tools and the seeds, the water pumps, the rototillers, things like this, so that they can have a sustainable source of food, you know, for the rest of their lives. And so that's what we've done. We've come in, we've trained some farmers, and who then are training other farmers as well. I mean, it's really basic things that they don't, you know, how to space your crops, how to water them, things like that. They've never been educated on that. So once they learn it, and what we're doing is we're micro-loaning some water pumps. So now they're able to, you know, to water their crops. We give them the seeds, and the gardens are exploding. We have five farmers right now, gardeners, farmers that have, either small gardens approaching small farms. So they're doing very well, paying back their loans for the water pumps. You know, we had one of our first farmers that do it. I think it was last year. He took his crop of tomatoes up to Molokol, and in 1 month he made $1,000, which is just, you know, it's amazing that, you know, it's quite an, so the $300 loan for the water pump, he was able to just come back and pay that off right away. Now he's asking about a row. I think he has a rototiller now. Now he's asking about maybe a boat, you know, loaning for a boat. So the potential there is huge for agriculture. But they would, if it wasn't for us or someone else doing it, it just wouldn't happen. And so it's just it's an exciting and vital program.
Tell us a little bit more about the microloan. My understanding is that idea grew out of India or Pakistan with one entrepreneurial guy. But how does it work? What's the idea here?
So, you know, the idea is if you need a pump or a rototiller to do your farm, obviously they don't have cash, right?
Okay.
I know the microloaning, I think, has been kind of a hot topic the last few years. A lot of times it's making small cash loans to people and then, you know, on low interest, and they can, to start up their business or whatever. So basic same idea. We're loaning them a direct asset in a sense, mm-hmm. A water pump, mm-hmm. or a rototiller. It's just that initial, I mean, there's no banks. There's no banks there. I mean, there'd be no other way for them to get that asset.
It's also sustainable in that way. Now you don't have to keep getting the loans, is the way my mind's working. Is that
absolutely,
is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you don't have to keep, you still need the money from somewhere, I mean, for other things, but once you get people going on this, they pay for the equipment that they've used, and it can be going to somebody else, and now they can get their own equipment.
Right. It's really very exciting. You look at Ty-X, what really is a farm now. I think he has about 15 acres, I think Brett said when he was last there. And his kids are clothed, and they are healthy, and that family is moving forward. It set an example up and down the river. So other people got in line saying, we want to do this. And we have about 13 families lined up in various stages of training. We send Stephen. He's our guy in the village. He's the local Sudanese that we've trained. He's working for us. He goes to these people. He teaches them how to plant. He shows them how to irrigate using the water pumps that we microloan to them. And these gardens are exploding. So this is up and down the Nile, about 30 kilometers between our various little projects going on there with gardening. And this is going to have a huge impact, because we loan to them the equipment, and then they pay us back as they sell their goods. These guys will be totally independent and become little little entrepreneurs along the river. It's really exciting, and I can see this just exploding. Maybe even getting into agricultural co-ops. That's something that we're just kind of toying with. We're not sure, but we do know that this program is gonna continue to really blossom and have a huge, long-term, sustainable impact without any input from us down the road.
I'm wondering, again, maybe not the most important thing to be wondering, is why agriculture didn't develop in this area. The Nile's been there for 2,000, 5,000 years. They've been farming the Nile. Why didn't this? Is it have something to do with the strains, the difficulty for plants to survive or food crops to survive? And I guess what I'm getting at is, have genetically modified foods enable things to happen there that couldn't happen somewhere else? Or what's the reason why this hasn't developed?
I think the war had a lot to do with it. Okay. You know, the two civil wars, like I say, when the gunboats would come up and down the river and blow the villages apart,
right. Okay.
People just scattered into the bush and left the river.
Yeah, it wasn't easy to stay by the river, even if you wanted to.
That's right. Couldn't stay. And so for those 40 years, people, if they had good gardening techniques, it wasn't passed down. They didn't know how to do it. There was no structure to set this thing up. A tragedy.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guests are Dr. Jack Hickel and Jason Hahn of the Alaska Sudan Medical Project. If you've got questions or comments about what you're hearing, let me give you some phone numbers again. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And at alaskapublic.org, you can get to direct links to the Alaska Sudan Medical Project and learn how to donate. What are your needs? What are the things that you need help with?
Well, you know, we're in the middle of quite a few projects right now, as we talked about. So, you know, it's kind of that holistic approach of just meeting the needs, their health needs. So we have the agricultural program. We have the water well program, needing to drill. You know, we just completed our fourth well just weeks ago. It was pretty exciting. We had a team go in and complete that. We're finishing a first medical clinic. This will be a new clinic for Dr. Jill to meet the kind of the expanding need of the population. Just a new, clean, modern, steel-structured facility. You know, she's operating out of this old, crumbling, colonial brick building that Jack mentioned. We have plans to build a second clinic right there in Old Fangak, and that one will be primarily for TB and infectious diseases. Is that is that correct, Jack?
Right.
And then also expanding the immunization program, as Jack mentioned. So I think those are the main kind of exciting programs, you know. And it's just this is just all privately funded. So we just rely on, you know, gracious donors, mostly here in Alaska, that just see what we're doing. They think it's a valuable investment, and they make their donations. And it's not easy. It's not cheap. It's logistically, as Jack mentioned, logistically difficult and expensive to get these, you know, items there. But once they're there, the impact that they're having is pretty amazing.
What about sanitation? You doing some work in that area as well?
That we are. All those villages practice open defecation, and all the diseases that are caused by that, as I'm certain everybody out there that's listening is aware. You can't practice open defecation and ever have a real grip on on the healthcare issues. So we have helped a group called MedAir. They came in for a couple of months and helped us. We helped them put in some pit latrines. And this is just a beginning. We've got about 26 of them in there. A couple of hand wash stations we're getting constructed to see if we can kind of change the way that people, you know, have we handle sanitation in the area. This is going to be huge. It's time intensive, of course. You have to have materials and welders and stuff like that to do that. But it's an area that we are focusing on because we do see the importance of it.
You mentioned before we came on the air also that you do now have some electricity, at least in the hospital, in the form of some solar, using some solar power. Is there opportunity or availability or need for more solar more solar power, or is that really sounds good but is not as helpful as you might think?
It's the only thing that'll really work in the long run. We had to bring in our own generators, of course, to run our welders and our well drilling equipment and everything else that we need to do to get things constructed. But having generators there is not an answer because it's too darn expensive. I mean, a gallon of gasoline this past year was nearly $30 a gallon. You know, nobody can afford that. So solar is really the way to go. Right now we have solar up, and Jill's clinic has a little bit of solar. She can run a couple of light bulbs. We have a couple of light bulbs run on solar power. That's the direction we really have to go. Of course, you're never going to run, huge drilling rigs off solar or anything like that. But we can provide electricity, which is key.
Not yet. I mean, that is one exciting area, is that the advances in solar technology right now. I mean, these people are basically going to be able to just skip over the whole petrol generation in a sense, right? You know, because with solar power, they're obviously the amount of sun, and for the duration of the year they have the sun. I think with new battery technologies and new solar panel technologies, you know, it's almost to the point where they could run just about all the needs that we have in the village on solar. It's just those are the things that we need to get in there. You know, they're not necessarily cheap, and you got to train the locals how to upkeep them. You know, give them a little lessons in that, because otherwise it's easy for them to, you know, even cleaning a solar panel, things like this, you have to make sure that they know how to do.
Back to the microloans and the agricultural development, which, I mean, seems like it's just a win-win-win situation, if there ever was one. What are the crops that are being developed and used there? And again, my mind goes to, you want to get the most bang for your buck, so you're looking for protein sources, which become very important, because when you got an area where there's a lot of disease, if you're malnourished, the disease is even more rampant, causes more severe disease problems than those people who are healthier.
Right now, what we are providing in terms of seeds are tomatoes, papaya trees, carrots, squash, onions, bananas,
corn,
sorghum, maize.
Mm-hmm. Eggplant.
Yep. Very exciting stuff.
So that sounds to me as fairly sustainable nutrition by itself, those things, right?
It is.
I mean,
yeah.
People around the world have lived on those things for a long time.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. I was, when I was just there recently, so the eggplants are, when you walk through the gardens and you see the tomatoes and the eggplants, it is impressive. You see the onions, you know, just popping out of the ground. It's impressive. So you see these nice juicy eggplants. I'm like, man, that, you know, I just want to go grab that thing right now. They don't like the eggplant. So they don't, you know, it's something they don't want to eat. So it's kind of funny. Steven, our local guy there, he actually gave a little class, impromptu class on how to cook eggplant. So he actually sat down, you know, cut up some eggplant, threw a couple things in it, and made a nice dish. And they had about like five or six farmers there. And he had them all sample his eggplant dish. And then they realized, oh, wow, eggplant can actually be good. It wasn't eggplant parmesan or anything, but right, it was still tasty, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you said that that the one farmer was making tomatoes, that's impressive.
Yeah, really is.
So that's got to be very rewarding to see something take off so well as this. And it really is due to the microloan issue, I would think.
It is, yeah. It's been one of the more exciting things that we've been involved in the past couple of years because we see a huge impact on people's lives and health. And the economy of the family, they can have a little income. They can now send their kids to school if there's a school. So the impact is huge. This has been so much fun. I'm so excited.
Where does the startup for the microloans? Do you have financial centers or agencies that are helpful? Or is this something you guys, you're the bank also, donations begin and you just imitate or work off of the other successful microloan programs?
All the money for our quote microloan program comes from listeners like we have today, from people like me and you that want to give.
But it's really keeps paying for itself. This is one of the really exciting things.
Well, yeah, because when we give a rotor tiller out, it gets paid back, and now we can give it to somebody else. Yeah. It's very exciting.
We've just got a couple of minutes left. I'd like to, if it's okay with you, talk about some other diseases. I know last time when we were here, Jill was, as my recollection, was really involved in tuberculosis, which was a much, much more devastating. It's a bad problem, but it was really devastating over there, I think probably because of the nutritional status of people, but I don't know. Tell us about tuberculosis. We don't hear enough about it, or we don't think enough about it in our society.
Tuberculosis is huge there. In Swaziland, we had the highest rate of TB in the world. But I don't know if they were counting South Sudan at that time because there was a war and who was getting statistics out of there. The TB there is astronomically so prevalent and devastating. And there's even a very virulent strain or whatever, but there's a lot of TB of the spine, more than I've ever seen elsewhere.
Yeah. The old name was Pott's disease.
Pott's disease, that's right, and it's crippling.
Yeah.
And it's devastating. There's a lot of TB there. Why? Well, there's a lot of people living together in these crowded little huts. The ventilation in these huts are terrible.
Poor nutrition.
The whole thing, all the things that could potentially make TB worse is all magnified right there in that region. And treating it, obviously, is very difficult. It takes it takes at least four medicines for months to treat it. And treating TB, if you don't have control of TB in your area, you'll never control anything else. The economics will never improve. Kids won't go to school, and the area will stay on its knees if you don't control TB.
What's the greatest killer there? Are we talking about disease-wise, or infectious disease, not malnutrition, which may be the underlying root to a lot of this? Is it gastrointestinal disease? Is it Kalizar? Is it tuberculosis? Is it something else?
You know, I'm not sure that we have good data on that. Of course, diarrheal disease is one of the main killer around the world, but that's often related to other stuff as well. I mean, kids are poorly nourished, they get pneumonia, and they get diarrhea, and they die because they just get dehydrated from the diarrhea. That's a huge, and respiratory disease is huge too. But the Kalizar and malaria and TB would be the real ones you have to tackle. If you tackle clean water, you'll tackle the diarrheal diseases by and large. But you still have to tackle the TB, the malaria, and the Kalizar. And those are the big killers.
I remember when I've talked to, and I don't remember, several years ago, someone who was doing a lot of work trying to get measles vaccination. Is there still something like a million people a day or something, or a year that are dying of measles?
Yeah. I can believe it.
Have you been successful enough with the measles vaccine, getting past all the supply problems to have an impact on how much measles you're seeing?
We only started the vaccine program in December.
So
it's brand new.
Uh-huh.
We don't know. But I know it'll have a huge impact when we get it done.
The population's pretty amenable to the vaccine issues. They seem to understand. I mean, there'd be a long history to see the advantages of that, perhaps.
People are very, I mean, the mothers, they bring their kids in, they know that this is life-saving for their kids. They have that degree of understanding of it, so they're very receptive. We'll go to a village like Toch, and people will just kind of come out of the bush over, 4 to 6, 8 hours, bringing their kids in, towing them behind them by the hand just to get their vaccines, and they disappear back into the bush somewhere.
I've written down, I don't know where I got this, maybe it's from your website, that 36% at least suffer from malnutrition. It says life expectancy is 42. That's the way the Western world was probably 150, 200 years ago. Female illiteracy, 90%. Only 10% of children are immunized. What's the results of, you know, female illiteracy, life expectancy, 42%, those kind of things? It seems like that you got lots of problems just with those particular bits of information.
It's huge. You know, we have the highest maternal mortality rate in the world, which is, it's an indicator of poor education. It's an indicator of lack of appropriate health care facilities. It's huge. Lack of education, illiteracy at 90%. You know, very few kids. I can't remember the exact percentage of kids at age 10 that have had any significant degree of education. But without education, we're missing out on a lot because people just don't have the knowledge base to know what to do and how to care for themselves.
We're in our last couple of minutes. Let me just leave these last couple of minutes for you guys to kind of express, again, what your needs are, the most important bits of information we want listeners to remember.
Well, you know, we always need volunteers, and we always need financial support is what it really comes down to. It's pretty exciting to be part of a program where we're a group of Alaskans. We're growing to this remote region in Sudan, and we're changing lives. I think there must be something special or crazy or something about Alaskans that are willing to go and, you know, sleep in their tent next to the Nile, you know, on the dirt floor and do this kind of work in kind of like rural conditions, really. And I think that's why Alaskans are drawn to it. I think that's why we've been successful, is because we're able to go and work in these remote areas. We have guys that go there that are volunteers that have plenty of experience doing that. And they're able to solve problems on the ground. You know, when generators break, when equipment breaks, hey, that's like doing, you know, a project out in the bush. And so I think that mindset and that skill set is really kind of what makes us successful. But we couldn't do it without our donors, you know, obviously. That's everything that we do. We don't have any major government sponsors or anything like that. So it's just, you know, it's just good people, good Alaskans seeing the work and thinking it's valuable.
Jack, you want to add to that? We got a minute.
And we can always use volunteer help here in town. People that may, we really have a need for somebody that can help us with our bookkeeping. People that can help update our website with newsletters, things like that. So there's work we can put people to work at right here in town.
And if you want to know how to get in touch with the Alaska Sudan Medical Project, you go to alaskapublic.org, look for Line 1. Today's program has a direct link to their website. Thanks very much. I appreciate your effort you're doing. Good luck on everything you're doing, and especially like the agriculture and the microloan idea. It seems like a wonderful one.
Thank you, Thad.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Next week, we're going to return, but before I tell you about next week's program, let me also remind you, you can continue this kind of conversation if you join KSKA on Facebook. You can find links on our website, again, at alaskapublic.org. So next Monday afternoon, April 2nd at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about healthcare costs again, and we'll be discussing with Mark Foster, an Anchorage healthcare analyst, the recent UAA Institute of Social and Economic Research report on Alaska healthcare costs. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped us today as an audio engineer. I want to say thanks to everyone for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.